Chapter 3. The Rich Eat Differently Than You and Me. I was holed up in the Caribbean about midway through a really bad time. My first marriage had just ended, and I was, to say the least, at loose ends. By loose ends, I mean aimless and regularly suicidal. I mean that my daily routine began with me waking up around 10, smoking a joint, and going to the beach, where I drink myself stupid on beer, smoke a few more joints, and pass out until mid-afternoon. This to be followed by an early evening rise, another joint, and then off to the bars, followed by the brothels. By then, usually very late at night, I'd invariably find myself staggeringly drunk, the kind of drunk where you've got to put a hand over one eye to see straight. On the way back from one whorehouse or another, I'd stop at the shawarma truck on the Dutch side of the island, and as best I could, shove a meat-filled pita into my face, sauce squirting onto my shirt front. Then, standing there in the dark parking lot, surrounded by a corona of spilled sauce, shredded lettuce and lamb fragments, I'd fire up another joint before sliding behind the wheel of my rented 4x4, yank the top down, then peel out onto the road with a squeal of tires. To put it plainly, I was driving drunk. Every night. There is no need to lecture me, to tell me what might have happened. That wasting my own stupid life is one thing, but that I could easily have crushed how many innocents under my wheels during that time. I know. Looking back, I break into an immediate cold sweat just thinking about it. Like a lot of things in my life, there's no making it prettier just 'cause time's passed. It happened. It was bad. There it is. There was a crazy-ass little independent radio station on this particular island, or maybe they broadcast it from another nearby island. I never figured it out. But it was one of those weird, inexplicable little anomalies of expat behavior that you find from time to time if you travel enough. A tiny, one-lung radio station in the middle of nowhere. A DJ whose playlist made no damn sense at all. Completely unpredictable selections ranging from the wonderfully obscure to the painfully familiar. From lost classics of garage rock, ancient cult psychobilly hits, and pre-disco funk masterpieces, to the most ubiquitously mundane medley of middle-of-the-road mainstays or parrothead anthems, in a flash. No warning. One second it's Jimmy Buffett or Loggins and Messina, the next, The Animals, House of the Rising Sun, or Question Mark and the Mysterians, 96 Tears. You never knew what was coming up. In the rare moments of lucidity when I tried to imagine who the DJ might be and what his story was, I'd always picture the kid from Almost Famous, holed up like me in the Caribbean for reasons he'd probably rather not discuss, only in his case, he'd brought his older sister's record collection, circa 1972. I like to imagine him out there in a dark studio, smoking weed and spinning records seemingly at random, or like me, according to his own seemingly aimless, barely under control, and very dark agenda. That's where I was in my life, driving drunk and way too fast across a not very well-lit Caribbean island every night. The roads were notoriously badly maintained, twisting and poorly graded. Other drivers, particularly at that hour, were, to put it charitably, as likely to be just as drunk as I was, and yet every night I pushed myself to go faster and faster. Life was reduced to a barely heard joke. A video game I'd played many times before. I'd light up the joint, crank up the volume, peel out of the parking lot, and it was game on. Here was the fun part. After making it past the more heavily trafficked roads of the Dutch side, after successfully managing to cross the unlit golf course off and over the green, and the ruins of the old resort flying heedlessly over the speed bumps, I'd follow the road until it began to twist along the cliff's edges approaching the French side. Here, I'd really step on the gas, and it was at precisely this point that I'd hand over control to my unknown DJ. For a second or two each night, for a distance of a few feet, I'd let my life hang in the balance, because depending entirely on what song came on the radio next, I'd decide to either jerk the wheel at the appropriate moment, continuing however recklessly to careen homeward, or simply straighten the fucker out and shoot over the edge and into the sea. In this way, my life could easily have ended with a badly timed playing of Loggins and Messina. On one memorable occasion, as I waited in the brief millisecond of silence between songs, foot on the gas, the cliff edge coming up at me fast, I was saved by the Chambers Brothers. I recognized the tick-tock of the metronome, knew by heart the first few bars of Time Has Come Today, and at the last second turned away from empty air, laughing and crying at the wonderfulness and absurdity of it all. The time has come today. Young hearts can go their way. Can't put it off another day on hissing and popping vinyl. I might get burned up by the sun, but I had my fun diverting me from what I very much felt to be my just deserts, making momentarily some strange and profound sense, saving my life. So, that's how I was feeling that year, and that's the kind of smart, savvy, well-considered decision-making process that was the norm for me. Back in New York, I was living in a small, fairly grim Hell's Kitchen walk-up apartment that smelled of garlic and red sauce from the Italian Hero joint downstairs. As I'd pretty much burned down my previous life, I didn't own much. Some clothes, a few books, a lot of Southeast Asian bric-a-brac. I was seldom there, so it didn't seem to matter. My favorite dive bar, where I was on permanent scholarship, was right down the street. I was not seeing anybody regular. I wasn't looking for love. I wasn't even looking for sex. I wasn't in a frame of mind to take the initiative with anybody. Yet, if you brushed up against me in those days, I'd probably go home with you if you asked. Business took me to England now and again, and one night, surely drunk again, sitting at the bar of a particularly disreputable club, waiting to meet someone from my publishers, I noticed a very beautiful woman staring at me in the mirror over my shoulder. While this was of moderate interest, it did not cause me to get off my bar stool, wink, nod, wave, or stare back. I had a pretty good sense by now of my unsuitability when it came to normal human interactions. I felt as if I'd had my thermostat removed, was without a regulator. I couldn't be trusted to behave correctly, to react appropriately, or to even discern what normal was. Sitting there hunched over my drink, I knew this, or sensed it, and was trying to avoid any contact with the world not based on business. But an intermediary, the woman's friend, took matters into her own hands, suddenly at my shoulder, insistent on making introductions. The woman and I got to know each other a little, and from time to time over the next few months we'd see each other in England and in New York. After a while, I came to understand that she was from a very wealthy family, that she kept an apartment in New York, that she spent her days mostly traveling to runway shows and buying things with her mother, that she was of British, French, and Eastern European background, spoke four languages beautifully, was smart, viciously funny, and at least a little crazy, a quality I usually liked in women. Okay, she had a problem with cocaine, something I'd moved past, and her t-shirts cost more than the monthly salaries of everybody I ever knew. But I flattered myself that I was the one guy she'd ever met who really and truly didn't give a shit about her money or her bloodline or what kind of muddle-headed upper-class twits she moved with. With the righteousness of the clueless, I saw all that as a liability and behaved accordingly, making the comfortable assumption that when you're that kind of wealthy and privileged, the kind her friends seemed to be, you were necessarily simple-minded, ineffectual, and generally useless. Suffering from the delusion that I was somehow saving this poor little rich girl, that surely she would benefit from a week on the beach, enjoying the simple pleasures of cold beer, a hammock, and local barbecue joints, I invited her to join me in the Caribbean over the Christmas holidays. For the last few weeks, I'd lived friendless and alone down there, in a small but very nice rented villa. The island was largely funky and downscale and charmingly dysfunctional. It was half French, half Dutch, with plenty of social problems, working poor, and a large population of locals going back many generations, meaning there was life and business outside of the tourism industry, an alternate version of the island where one could, if one so desired, get lost, away from one's own kind. I'd been weeks without shoes, eating every meal with my hands. Who wouldn't love that, I thought. She came, and for just short of a week, we had a pretty good time. We were both hitting the Havana Club a little hard for sure, but her presence certainly improved my behavior. My nightly attempts at suicide ended, and I believed that I was good for her as well. She seemed for a while genuinely happy and relaxed on the island's out-of-the-way beaches, perfectly satisfied, it appeared to me, with a routine of inexpensive Johnny Cake sandwiches and roadside pork ribs grilled in sawed-off 55-gallon drums. She took long swims by herself, emerging from the water looking beautiful and refreshed. I thought, surely this is a good thing. Maybe we are good for each other. We drank at sailor bars, took mid-afternoon naps, mixed rum punches with a frequency that over time became a little worrisome. She was damaged, I knew, like me, I thought, flattering myself. I identified with her distrust of the world. but as I would come to learn, hers was a kind of damage I hadn't seen before. "Let's go to St. Bart's," she said one afternoon. This was an idea that held little attraction for me. Even then, in my state of relatively blissful ignorance, I knew that St. Bart's, which lay about 10 miles offshore from my comfortably dowdy island, was not somewhere I could ever be happy. I knew from previous day trips that a hamburger and a beer cost $50, that there was no indigenous culture to speak of, that it was the very height of the holiday season, and the island, not my scene in the best of circumstances, would be choked with every high-profile douche, Euro-douche, wannabe, and oligarch with a mega-yacht. I knew enough of the place to know that St. Bart's was not for me. I made obliging, generically willing-sounding noises, fairly secure in the assumption that every rental car and hotel room on the island had been booked solid. A few calls confirmed this to be the case, and I felt that surely she dropped the idea. She would in no way, she insisted, be deterred by insignificant details like no place to stay and no way to get there. There was a house, Russian friends, everything would work out. It certainly wasn't love that compelled me to abandon all good sense and go somewhere I already hated with somebody I barely knew in a circumstances of great uncertainty. It was not a period of my life marked by good decisions, but in agreeing to pop over to St. Bart's, I'd made a particular whopper of a wrong turn, a plunge into the true heart of darkness. Maybe I saw it at the time as the path of least resistance. Maybe I even thought there was indeed some small possibility of a good time. But I surely had reason to know better. I did know better, but I walked straight into the grinder anyway. We took a small propeller plane the 10 minutes or so across the water, landing at the airport with no ride, no plans, no friends I was aware of, and no place to stay. A famous guy said hello to my friend by the luggage carousel. They exchanged witty banter. He did not, however, offer to let us crash at his place. There were no taxis in sight. From a comfortable rented villa on a nice island where, despite my nightly flirtations with vehicular homicide and suicide, I was at least able to swim, eat and drink fairly cheaply, and eventually sleep securely in my own bed, I now found myself suddenly homeless. Worse, my partner, as I quickly discovered, was a spoiled, drunk, and frequently raving paranoid schizophrenic. And cokehead. Did I mention that? Any pretense that mysterious Russian friends with a villa would be there for us had somehow dematerialized somewhere on the flight over. Similar departures from reality would become a regular feature of the next few days. After a long time, we found a taxi to a hotel where, once the staff laid eyes on my mysterious but increasingly mad companion, a room was hastily made available for a night. A very expensive room. One of the things I'd forgotten about seriously wealthy people, something I'd noticed during a brief previous exposure at college, was that the old-school, old-money kind of rich people, those motherfuckers don't pay for shit. They don't carry cash, and even credit cards seem always to be somewhere else, as if whatever small sums as might be needed are beneath notice or discussion. Better you pay. And pay I did. Days and nights binging on overpriced drinks, bribing bartenders to scoop us up in their private vehicles at end of shift and drive us off into the dark to wherever she thought we might stay that night. One crappy motel-style room after another that cost what a suite at the St. Regis would. More drinks. By now, I was a prisoner of her escalating and downright scary mood swings and generally bad craziness. She'd turn on a dime from witty and affectionate to hissing, spitting psychotic. One minute we'd be having overpriced mojitos on a lovely beach, the next she'd be raging at the manager, accusing the busboy or whoever was at hand of stealing her cell phone. Fact was, she constantly misplaced her cell phone, her purse, anything of value she had. She'd get sloshed, forgetful, impulsively run off to dance, to search for coke, to say hello to an old friend, and she'd lose track of shit. She'd forget where she'd put things, if she'd ever had them in the first place. I am not a fan of people who abuse service staff. In fact, I find it intolerable. It's an unpardonable sin as far as I'm concerned, taking out personal business or some other kind of dissatisfaction on a waiter or busboy. From the first time I saw that, our relationship was essentially over. She accused me of caring about waiters more than I cared about her, and she was right. From that point on, I was babysitting a madwoman. feeling obliged only to get her crazy ass on a plane and back to England as quickly as possible and with as little damage done as could be managed. I'd gotten her here, allowed this to happen. It was impingent on me, I felt, to at least get her back in one piece. This was easier said than done. People were afraid of her. I noticed this early on. She had mentioned something earlier back in England about an ex-boyfriend who'd supposedly stalked her, how Mom had had to call some friends to talk to the fellow in question, how there'd been no problems after that. Somehow I'd blown right past that flashing red warning light, too, along with all the others. Now all I wanted to do was get her on a plane back to London, but it was like reasoning with a wild animal. She didn't want to go, wouldn't go. By now, middle of the night, she'd jacked the volume on the TV all the way up and flicked rapidly back and forth between news stations raving about oil prices. Strangely, neither neighbors nor management ever dared complain. I went to sleep each night not knowing where we'd sleep the next, if I'd wake up in a bed soaked with blood of indeterminate origin, afraid to open my eyes to find out if the girl had cut her wrists or my throat. I tried, really tried, to act as I thought one does with a genuinely crazy person. Solicitous. Like a gentleman, until one can get him safely back in the bug house. But she dragooned people into helping us, strangers and distant acquaintances who seemed to like the idea of chauffeuring around a crazed heiress and giving her cocaine. She crashed parties, jumped lines, scarfed grams at will, a magnet for indulgent enablers, reptilian party throwers. "What does she do?" I heard one admiring bystander ask of another as my roomie bounded gazelle-like across the dance floor towards the bathroom, there no doubt to fill her nostrils. Nothing was the answer, as if this was the proudest profession of all. Apparently familiar with her rapier wit, her way with a lasting cruel remark, those who knew her from Saint-Tropez, from Monaco, from Sardinia, wherever fuckwits and fameballs went that year, they cowered at her approach. No one stood up to her. Maybe it was because they all hated each other. It seemed the point of the whole exercise. I soon found out that to move in this woman's poisonous orbit was to willingly attach oneself to a sinister global network of Italian art collectors, creepy Russian oligarchs, horny internet billionaires, the wrinkled ex-wives of Indonesian despots, princelings from kingdoms that long ago ceased to exist, mistresses of African dictators, former hookers turned millionaires, and the kind of people who like hanging around with such people, or who make their living doing so. All seem to have come to St. Bart's over the holidays in order to find subtle new ways to say fuck you to each other, with a smile, of course. We spent a somewhat less than romantic New Year's Eve at a party hosted by the Gaddafis. That should tell you something. Enrique Iglesias provided the entertainment, a detail that lingers in the memory like the birthmark on one's torturer's cheek. Who had the bigger boat, wore the better outfit, got the best table, seemed all that mattered. There were decade-old feuds over casual cracks long forgotten by everyone but the principals. They circled each other still, waiting to identify a weakness, looking for somewhere and some way to strike. People jockeyed for position, cut each other's throats over the most petty, nonsensical shit imaginable. This from the people who, it gradually began to dawn on me, actually ran the world. I was lingering over the buffet on a Dr. No-sized yacht with the appropriately Bond-esque name Octopus. Huge interior docking inside the hull, a six-man submarine, landing space for two helicopters. Francis Bacon originals in the crapper. I looked up from the sushi and got the impression that anybody there, any of the guests dancing, schmoozing, chatting politely at the party, would have watched my throat getting cut without the slightest change in expression. By the time she lost her wallet for the third and last time, I was ready to dig a hole in the sand and drop her in it. Had I thought for a second, I could get away with it. But she spoke daily with Mom, and the option of simply walking out on her, leaving the walletless, funless, coke-crazy, schizo bitch to her just desserts, broke ass in a hotel room from which I had every expectation she would be removed at any hour, this too I was uncomfortable with. I also had a very real concern that even were I to do something as measured and sensible as simply walk out on her, what remained of my Caribbean sojourn might end with the arrival of two thick-necked fellows from Chechnya holding a tarpaulin and hacksaws. I was a bad person in a bad place with another bad person surrounded by other, possibly even worse people. The French, who administered this playground of evil, who serviced its visitors, knew their customers well, and catered to them, accommodated them, gouged them, and fucked them over in all the traditional ways, and a few new ones. Sit down for a burger at a beach bar, and suddenly the music starts thump-thumping, and here come the models with the swimwear for sale, or jewelry. It was a bottle service world, meaning you pay for the table, not what's on it. Unless, of course, you're like my companion, who had a way of looking confused at the suggestion that anyone would pay for anything, much less her. 50-ish men with pot bellies hanging out over their Speedos danced with pneumatic-breasted Ukrainian whores during brunch. Overgroomed little dogs in diamond chokers snapped and barked at one's heels. Waiters looked at everyone with practiced expressions of bemused contempt. There was, however, one glimmer of light or inspiration in all this darkness. One man on the island understood better than anyone the world my companion moved in. An artist, a genius, a man who stood alone in his ability, the sheer relish with which he fucked the rich. Let's call him, for the purposes of this discussion, Robert, the man who took what might be described as the Cipriani business model to its most extreme yet logical extension, and a man whose example gave me, in some ways, the strength to endure. The Ciprianis, along with a few other operators and imitators, made, a long while back, a remarkable discovery. That rich, international fucktards like to hang out with each other and eat marginally decent Italian food and are willing to pay outrageous amounts of money for the privilege. Better yet, all the people who want to look like they too are rich international fucktards will want to get in on the action as well. That's the customer base that dreams are made of. If you go to Harry's Bar in Venice, you get a pretty good plate of food, and the Bellinis are just fine. They just cost a fuck of a lot. But they do treat you courteously, and it is Venice out the window, and everything's expensive anyway. I'm guessing the Ciprianis figured out that if this model worked in Venice, it would work in New York, that maybe $29 for a bowl of spaghetti with red sauce is perfectly reasonable. In New York, it is a cruel irony of Italian food that the more ingredients in your spaghetti with red sauce and the more time and steps spent preparing it, the more it costs to prepare, the less likely it is to be good. It will also usually be cheaper on the menu. Consider, though, a basic, authentic, just like in Italy spaghetti al pomodoro. A few ounces of good quality dry-cut pasta, a few drops of olive oil, garlic, some tomato, and a basil leaf. This will cost you $29, and the drink that precedes it will cost at least $17. Essentially, you are paying extra for someone to not fuck up your food. Many who gazed admiringly at the Ciprianis took things a little further, realizing that decent food was in no way necessary. Rich international douchebags and those who love them will happily pay those kinds of prices simply to be jammed into tiny dollhouse-sized banquettes, cheek by Botox jowl at Nello, or to poke at faux Chinese food in graveyards of the uber-rich like Mr. Chow and Philippe. Add to the mix some curiously available Eastern European women who find low-riding ball sacks distinctly fascinating, you've got yourself a recipe for success. But Robert, on St. Bart's, he had it all figured out. He took the model where it should have been all along, cut things right to their very core nubbin of ugliness. You don't have to have decent food. On the contrary, you can explicitly and with great care and determination, he discovered, serve shit. You don't need a nice room, fancy tablecloths, flowers, or even Russian hookers. You need only a nice location, in this case, a wood-planked beachfront patio deck, and an attitude. Specifically, you need a reputation as an ornery fuck who doesn't give a shit about anything or anybody. Then, like Robert, you can not only fuck the rich, you could fuck each and every one of them personally, one at a time, just bend them over a sawhorse in order, and roger them up the poop chute while they thank you repeatedly. At his restaurant, for 25 euros, about $35 then, one gets a few grams of cold, unseasoned, boiled lentils on a very large plate. Lentils. That's it. About 2 tablespoons of them, with not so much as a carrot chunk or a limp dice of onion to distinguish them from what some street kid with a skateboard and a hacky sack is eating right now in a parking lot in Portland. Probable food cost to Robert, maybe 2 cents. Feel free to season with oil and vinegar, though, provided complimentary. For the main course, there is the option of chicken or fish. Chicken is one leg, which Robert himself, That's him, the scowling, shirtless, and unshaven fellow over there, wearing an apron, shorts, and flip-flops, will personally burn into unrecognizability for you. Nothing less than carbonized will satisfy his exacting standards. Robert will take the extra step to ruin your chicken each and every time. People who've had the temerity to step over to the grill preemptively and suggest that perhaps this order could be a little less cooked find themselves quickly in the street next to Madonna. The fish option is a small, barely cleaned whole red snapper, prepared with similar attention to detail, which is to say, burned to shit. Price for these delights of land and sea? 50 euros, about 75 bucks each. Add a chilled bottle of the cheapest rosé on the list to stave off the summer's heat and ameliorate perhaps the taste of campfire in your mouth, and you're talking $500 for lunch. Merci, and fuck you very much. And yet, they line up. They beg, they try and bribe, they conspire, they whisper loudly into their cell phones to friends in Saint-Tropez or Punta del Este or Rome, trying to reach someone with influence over the situation so that they may visibly swan past less favored mortals and sit triumphant on the patio of the gods. If, as the man says, behind every great fortune there is a crime, then surely many of these customers have sanctioned every variety of cold-blooded behavior in the interests of a few dollars here and there. Relocating African villages, flooding valleys, gouging the infirm, dumping toxins down wells, and knocking off the inconvenient when circumstances require. But for Robert, they cheerfully grab their ankles, and they don't even ask for a reach-around. Kind of begs the question, why? It's a question I've been wrestling with since early in my career, when I was charged with the care and refilling of the trays and hotel pans at the Rockefeller Center Luncheon Club, where the masters of the financial universe ate every daytime meal at our sorry-ass buffet of the damned. I wondered what might have compelled these people who single-handedly decided the fate of nations, the captains of industry, the fabulously wealthy wives of potentates, scions of old European families who didn't even remember where their money came from. Why would these people cower in the dreary confines of the lunch club, or fight tooth and nail clawing over the bodies of their friends to eat truly awful, insultingly priced food on a shabby pool deck abused by a man of no standing or station whom, under ordinary circumstances, they would have set the hounds on without a second's thought? Why, for that matter, tolerate the absurd pretense and prices of Mr. Chow or Philippe or Nello or Cipriani when there are 100 better restaurants within a few moments' drive? What my horrible week on St. Bart's taught me was that this traveling strata of mega-rich people, all of whom know each other, crave nothing more than the comfort, the assurance, that they're going to the same crummy place as everybody else. Perhaps this explains why they all go to the same lousy beaches, usually narrow, pebbly, and unimpressive stretches of oft-reeking sand that would be unacceptable to any half-season backpacker, and to restaurants that any food nerd with a website and a few bucks would walk sneeringly by. Try arguing the virtues of Nello on Chowhound.com or a similar online meeting ground for knowledgeable food nerds, and prepare to get pilloried. So why would people who can afford to eat anywhere obligingly allow themselves to be charged outrageous amounts of money for food that's on its very best day mediocre? A clue came to me on St. Bart's as I lay on a chaise lounge, half-drunk in the moonlight, various Gaddafis and their guests frolicking in the background. Perhaps it's that they're so ugly, these beautiful people. They wear the same ugly clothes designed by the same misogynistic old queens who must privately piss themselves with laughter seeing their older, richer clientele squeezing into these outfits, leading one to the observation that the style makers themselves, the people who decide what the world will wear next year, who's pretty, what's hot, and what's not, are uniformly hideous beyond the lurid imaginings of Cub Scouts round a campfire. Just look at the guest judges on Project Runway or America's Next Top Model, or at the front row of any fashion show, and you'll get the idea. A dumpier, less attractive, more badly dressed bunch of customers would be hard to find outside a suburban dress barn. Rick James in the 1970s could never have gotten away with what Karl Lagerfeld wears every day. He'd have been hooted off the stage. If Donatella Versace showed up at your door selling Amway products, you'd slam it and double lock it before calling the neighbors to warn them. As I looked around the beach, I saw, in the jaundiced light of my unhappiness, the full extent of the horror of this island of Dr. Moreau I'd willingly maroon myself on, The full spectrum of plastic surgeries gone wrong, right there in the open. Curiosities of the flesh, which at a lesser income level would have been confined to the carnival sideshow. Mouths that pulled to the side, lips plumped beyond credibility, cheeks filled with golf ball-like lumps, and foreheads frozen so tight you could play snare drum on them. Identical noses, eyes that refused to blink and could barely even close. And there was my date for the night, in her $1,000 plain white t-shirt, searching, once again, for her cell phone. It makes sense that restaurant operators and Robert would prey on these people. They should. They are, after all, in the business of desire, of figuring out what fulfills their clients' wants and needs. What they want on St. Bart's, as elsewhere, I'm guessing, is to feel secure among others of their ilk. Secure that they've chosen the right place, the place everybody else in their set will choose. Secure that if nothing else, everyone else in attendance will have bought into the shared illusion. Where no one will point out the obvious, that they're too old and too ugly to be wearing what they're wearing. That the surgery didn't help. That they can't and shouldn't, in fact, dance ever again. That they're eating food that the cleanup guy who's going to sweep up after closing wouldn't touch with rubber gloves and andirons. That the rest of the people on this planet, if enough of them knew who they really were and how they made their money, would have their heads quickly on pikes. In the end, I walked away. After she lost her cell phone for the fourth time, I saw her drunkenly survey the room, eyeballing other partygoers for suspects. I watched as her insane gaze finally settled on the entourage of a prominent gangster rapper who'd taken over the VIP section of the tented restaurant patio. Specifically, on two very large women, thick-necked and unfriendly-looking to begin with, both wearing midnight sunglasses, either of whom could easily have taken me in a fair fight. In the kind of slow-motion approach that so often precedes disaster, I watched as my companion confronted the two women, accusingly demanding to know where her cell phone was. The music was playing very loud, so I didn't hear their reaction. But assuming they responded with, "What the fuck do I want with your cell phone, bitch, and you're accusing us because we're black," they would have been demonstrating impeccable logic. Utterly disgusted, I now no longer cared if in the weeks to follow I was found in a culvert with my feet sawed off. I no longer cared if there'd be a price to pay later for escape. It was all just too awful to bear, much less look at anymore. I needed to get out now. I'd had enough. Let her dig her own crazy ass out of this ever-building shitstorm. I pulled her over and said as much, then lurched out of the restaurant and down the road. I packed my bag, arranged with the front desk for her to have two more nights at the hotel should she need to, and then walked a mile or so to the airport, where I spent the night on a bench. I took the first flight out and landed on my old, familiar, and decidedly more friendly island 10 minutes later. I retrieved my rental car from the long-term parking and drove gratefully home, where I quickly curled up in the fetal position and slept like the dead for 24 hours. I stayed home, avoiding bars, brothels, and even beaches for the rest of my time on the island. I'd had enough. Somewhere along the line, I'd stared evil in the face, and it had frightened me to my core. I don't know whether it was something I saw in St. Bart's or in the mirror during the worst year of my life, but something had to change. I knew that now. Chapter 4. I Drink Alone. People call me Chef. Still. Walking down the street, I'll hear somebody call that out, and my head still swivels to see who's talking to me. 9 years now since I last took up a pan in anger, and I still whip around automatically to that title. Of course, it's no longer true. I'm not a chef. Still, it usually makes me happy when I hear that. There's something wonderful about drinking in the afternoon. A not-too-cold pint, absolutely alone at the bar, even in this fake-ass Irish pub. It's new, built to look like old. Erin Go Bra bullshit with its four flat screens silently flashing sports crawls for games I don't care about. The generic Irish bric-a-brac they deliver by the truckload. Empty moving vans roaming the Irish countryside right now, I imagine, waiting for old Mrs. Maher to drop dead into her black pudding so they can buy up the contents of her curio shelves. All of it shipped straight off to a central clearinghouse where it's divvied up between instant Irish pubs in New York, Milwaukee, Singapore, and Verona. I've been at this bar before, of course. We all have. Yet I'm strangely, indefensibly happy here. Even the stink of Lysol from the too clean floor, the fruit flies hovering over the garnish tray do not distract me from a general feeling of well-being. The food, were I silly enough to ask, well, I know what's on the menu without looking. Fried zucchini sticks, fried mozzarella, surely there's calamari and red sauce. Look deeper and there will be indifferently prepared shepherd's pie, a French dip with salty gravy made from canned base, a burger with a limp pickle, an unripe tomato slice, and Simplo classic frozen French fries. Bangers and mash will be an Italian sweet sausage, and there might be a gummy approximation of Irish stew containing two lean lamb bits and lots of potatoes. And what of the seafood options? You are on your fucking own there, boyo. The bartender is Irish. Jumped a student visa about 10 years ago, but nothing for him to worry about. The cook, though, is Mexican. Some poor bastard at $10 an hour and probably has to wash the dishes, too. La Migra take notice of his immigration status, they catch sight of his bowl cut on the way home to Queens, and he'll have a problem. He looks different than the Irish and the Canadians, and he's got Lou Dobbs calling specifically for his head every night on the radio. You notice, by the way, that you never hear Dobbs wringing his hands over our border to the north. Maybe the white in Great White North makes that particular alien superhighway more palatable. The cook at the Irish bar, meanwhile, has the added difficulty of predators waiting by the subway exit for him and any other Mexican cooks or dishwashers when he comes home on Friday payday. He's invariably cashed his check at a check cashing store. He's relatively small and is unlikely to call the cops. The perfect victim. The guy serving my drinks, on the other hand, as most English-speaking illegal aliens, has been smartly gaming the system for years, a time-honored process everybody at the INS is fully familiar with. A couple of continuing education classes now and again while working off the books to get those student visas. Extensions, a work visa, a farm visa, weekend across the border, and repeat. Articulate, well-connected friends, the type of guys who own, for instance, lots of Irish bars, who can write letters of support lauding your invaluable and specialized skills, unavailable from homegrown bartenders. And nobody's looking anyway. But I digress. Bushmills or Jameson, Celtics or Rangers, don't mean a thing here. This is a non-denominational Irish bar. No difference, no raised eyebrows. Few Irish, now that I think about it, and the Guinness, of course, blows. The owner's got 10 or 12 of these bars, and they all look the same, and they all have names like Patty McGee's or Seamus O'Doul's or Molly whatever, none of whom exist or ever existed. But I am happy here just the same. Among the pool table, the jukebox, the inevitable dartboard, the moose head, toy trains, Yankee banners, the photos of Irish authors who never came here and whom nobody here ever read. You want to talk Joyce or Behan? A Yeats bust may sit dust-covered on a shelf, but start spouting lines from the Second Coming, and you could just fuck off down the street, you prat. Who drinks here? Office workers, jackets off, tie still on, or the reverse, jacket on, tie off. Restaurant help, nipping out for a drink, coming off a shift, fortifying themselves for the shift to come. Beaten down by life. Not broken, mind you, not beaten down like a coal miner or an out-of-work steel worker, just dissatisfied with the way things have turned out. Not quite ready to go home just yet. Picture just a little too clear to get on the train at this precise moment. Better, it has been decided to fuzz things a little around the edges before moving back into their other lives. I feel right at home here, until Gnarls Barkley's Crazy comes on the sound system, which brings me right back to Beirut, as it always does, and I'm pretty sure nobody else at this bar is feeling the same way I am right now. Not like I'm talking post-traumatic stress or anything. I mean, it wasn't that bad for me. I mean, a sudden sadness, a sense and awareness of dislocation. That image of a Mediterranean, European, Arab city on the sea, rockets coming in from the horizon, floating lazily above the airport, then dropping with a delayed bang. The smell of burning jet fuel. More than anything else, the song makes me feel separated from what might, in another life, 10 years ago, have otherwise been my drinking buddies at the bar. I'll never be a regular at this bar, or any bar, not even a writer's bar. If you've ever spent 10 minutes in one of those, a bunch of bitter, snowy-haired, bilious fucks with gin blossom noses and ballooning guts, talking too loud and laughing too hard and secretly hating each other, you'll reconsider ever putting another word to paper. As much as I admire the work of good writers, I found that hanging out with more than one of them at a time is about as much fun as being thrown into a cage full of hungry but toothless civet cats. "You're not a chef," says the kid at the bar. Another bar. A chef's bar this time, late at night. I'm probably on a book tour and out for drinks with the kitchen crew from my hotel. Is it Portland? Seattle? Vancouver? Who remembers? "You're not a chef," he repeats, giving me the stink eye, unsteady on his feet. "You don't even cook." The others with me, fresh off a long shift in the kitchen, shrink back a little, uncomfortable with the situation. They like me fine. I did write Kitchen Confidential, after all, but let's face it, the kid is right. He's drunk, and he's angry, and like a lot of people who own well-thumbed, food-splattered, water-damaged copies of that book, or who've borrowed a copy from the guy who works next to them, he feels betrayed. I'm a heretic now, having abandoned him and everyone like him, repudiated the one true church of the working cook. Look at me in my nice fucking jacket, standing there all famous and shit. "Fuck you," he says. "You don't even cook. You're not one of us anymore." Far from being offended, though I am hurt, I want to give him a big hug. Another drink or two, and I just might. I don't cook. I'm not a chef. The chefs and cooks who are better than I used to be, better than I ever was, they know this and don't need to say it. They certainly don't need to say it to my face like this kid, pressing me up against the bar now with the force of his rage and hurt. He will channel these feelings appropriately, and it would demand that I do a shot of tequila with him, or two, which is a relatively friendly and diplomatic solution to an awkward situation. It's the guys who are most like me who feel most disappointed in me. The hackers. They'll wake up every fucking day and drag your ass into pretty much one place same as the other to make food you don't particularly like for people you like even less. The ones who smell of fryer grease and burned salmon fat. When I decline the offer of a third shot, he will at least have had the satisfaction of proving me a pussy, which will be a victory of sorts. And when eventually he sags to the side in his booth, his comrades at arms looking on tolerantly, and slips into unconsciousness, I will still be thinking about what he said. That he was right. Chapter 5. So You Want to Be a Chef? I am frequently asked by aspiring chefs, dreamers young and old, attracted by the lure of slowly melting shallots and caramelizing pork belly, or delusions of Food Network stardom, if they should go to culinary school. I usually give a long, thoughtful, and qualified answer. But the short answer is no. Let me save you some money. I was in the restaurant business for 28 years, much of that time as an employer. I am myself a graduate of the finest and most expensive culinary school in the country, the CIA, and am as well a frequent visitor and speaker at other culinary schools. Over the last 9 years, I have met and heard from many culinary students on my travels, have watched them encounter triumphs and disappointments. I have seen the dream realized, and more frequently, I have seen the dream die. Don't get me wrong, I'm not telling you that culinary school is a bad thing. It surely is not. I'm saying that you, reading this right now, would probably be ill-advised to attend, and are, in all likelihood, unsuited for the life in any case, particularly if you're any kind of normal. But let's say you're determined. You're planning on taking out a student loan and taking on a huge amount of debt. In many cases from lenders associated with or recommended by your local culinary school. Ask yourself first, is this culinary school even any good? If you're not going to the Culinary Institute of America, Johnson & Wales, or the French Culinary Institute, you should investigate this matter even more intently, because the fact is, when you graduate from the Gomer County Technical College of Culinary Arts, nobody hiring in the big leagues is going to give a shit. A degree from the best culinary schools is no guarantee of a good job. A degree from anywhere less than the best schools will probably be less helpful than the work experience you could have had you been out there in the industry all that time. You're about to take on $40,000 to $60,000 in debt training for an industry where, if you're lucky, you will, for the first few years, be making $10 to $12 an hour. In fact, if you are really, really lucky, one of the few supremely blessed with talent, ability, and great connections deemed worthy enough to recommend you to one of the great kitchens of Europe or New York for your post-school apprenticeship, you will essentially be making nothing for the first couple of years. You will, once living expenses are factored in, probably be paying for the experience. Should you be fortunate enough to be among the 1 in a million young cooks taken on at a famous and respected restaurant like Arzak in Spain, for example, this will truly be time and money well spent. If you perform well, you will return home never again needing a resume. In this case, the investment of all your time and money and hard work will have paid off. But the minute you graduate from school, unless you have a deep-pocketed mommy and daddy or substantial savings, you're already up against the wall. 2 nearly unpaid years wandering Europe or New York learning from the masters is rarely an option. You need to make money now. If that imperative prevails, requiring that you work immediately for whomever will have you, once you embark on a career dictated by the need for immediate cash flow, it never gets any easier to get off the treadmill. The more money you get paid straight out of school, the less likely you are to ever run off and do a stage in the great kitchens of the world. Time cooking at Applebee's may get you paid, but it's a period best left blank on the resume if you're planning on ever moving to the bigs. It may just as well have never happened. Country clubs? Hotel kitchens? These are likely employers straight out of school, and they promise a pretty decent, relatively stable career if you do well. It's a good living, with, unlike most of the restaurant business, reasonable hours and working conditions, and most hotels and country clubs offer the considerable advantage of health insurance and benefits. But that sector of the trade is like joining the mafia. Once you enter the warm fold of their institutional embrace, it's unlikely you'll ever leave. Once in, rarely out. If it matters to you, watch groups of chefs at food and wine festivals or wherever industry people congregate and drink together after work. Observe their behaviors as if spying on animals in the wild. Notice the hotel and country club chefs approach the pack. Immediately, the eyes of the pack will glaze over a little bit at the point of introduction. The hotel or country club species will be marginalized, shunted to the outside of the alpha animals. With jobs and lives that are widely viewed as being cushier and more secure, they enjoy less prestige and less respect. You could, of course, opt for the private chef route upon graduating. But know that for people in the industry, the words private and chef just don't go together. To real chefs, such a concept doesn't even exist. A private chef is domestic help, period. A glorified butler. Somewhere slightly below food stylist and above consultant on the food chain. It's where the goofs who wasted a lot of money on a culinary education only to find out they couldn't hack it in the real world end up. How old are you? Nobody will tell you this, but I will. If you're 32 years old and considering a career in professional kitchens, if you're wondering if perhaps you are too old, let me answer that question for you. Yes, you are too old. If you're planning on spending big bucks to go to culinary school at your age, you'd better be doing it for love. A love, by the way, that will be, almost without a doubt, unreciprocated. By the time you get out of school at 34, even if you're fucking Escoffier, you will have precious few useful years left to you in the grind of real-world working kitchens. That's if you're lucky enough to even get a job. At 34, you will immediately be grandpa or grandma to the other inevitably much, much younger, faster-moving, more physically fit cooks in residence. The chef, also probably much younger, will view you with suspicion, as experience has taught him that older cooks are often dangerously set in their ways, resistant to instruction from their juniors, generally slower, more likely to complain, get injured, call in sick, and come with inconvenient baggage like normal family lives and responsibilities outside of the kitchen. Kitchen crews work best and happiest when they are tight, when they operate like a long touring rock band, and chances are you will be viewed upon showing up with your knife roll and your resume as simply not being a good fit, a dangerous leap of faith, hope, or charity by whoever was dumb enough to take a chance on you. That's harsh, but it's what they'll be thinking. Am I too fat to be a chef? Another question you should probably ask yourself. This is something they don't tell you at admissions to culinary school either, and they should. They're happy to take your money if you're 5'7" and 250 pounds, but what they don't mention is that you will be at a terrible, terrible disadvantage when applying for a job in a busy kitchen. As chefs know, literally in their bones and joints, half the job for the first few years, if not the entirety of your career, involves running up and down stairs quickly, carrying bus pans loaded with food and making hundreds of deep knee bends a night into low-boy refrigerators. In conditions of excruciatingly high heat and humidity of a kind that can cause young and superbly fit cooks to falter. There are the purely practical considerations as well. Kitchen work areas, particularly behind the line, being necessarily tight and confined. Bluntly put, can the other cooks move easily around your fat ass? I'm only saying it, but any chef considering hiring you is thinking it, and you will have to live it. If you think you might be too fat to hack it in a hot kitchen, you probably are too fat. You can get fat in a kitchen, over time, during a long and glorious career, but arriving fat from the get-go? That's a hard and narrow road to hoe. If you're comforting yourself with the dictum, never trust a thin chef, don't, because no stupider thing has ever been said. Look at the crews of any really high-end restaurants, and you'll see a group of mostly whippet-thin, under-rested young pups with dark circles under their eyes. They look like escapees from a Japanese prison camp and are expected to perform like the Green Berets. If you're not physically fit, unless you're planning on becoming a pastry chef, it is going to be very tough for you. Bad back, flat feet, respiratory problems, eczema, old knee injury from high school? It sure isn't going to get any better in the kitchen. Male, female, gay, straight, legal, illegal, country of origin, who cares? You can either cook an omelet or you can't. You can either cook 500 omelets in 3 hours like you said you could and like the job requires, or you can't. There's no lying in the kitchen. The restaurant kitchen may indeed be the last glorious meritocracy where anybody with the skills and the heart is welcomed. But if you're old or out of shape or were never really certain about your chosen path in the first place, then you will surely and quickly be removed. Like a large organism's natural antibodies fighting off an invading strain of bacteria, the life will slowly push you out or kill you off. Thus it is, thus it shall always be. The ideal progression for a nascent culinary career would be to first take a jump straight into the deep end of the pool. Long before student loans and culinary school, take the trouble to find out who you are. Are you the type of person who likes the searing heat, the bad pace, the never-ending stress and melodrama, the low pay, probable lack of benefits, inequity, futility, the cuts and burns and damage to body and brain, the lack of anything resembling normal hours or a normal personal life? Or are you like everybody else, a normal person? Find out sooner rather than later. Work for free if necessary in a busy kitchen. Any kitchen that will have you will do. In this case, a busy Applebee's or TGI Fridays or any old place will be fine. Anybody who agrees to let your completely inexperienced ass into their kitchen for a few months and then helpfully kicks it repeatedly and without let-up will suffice. After 6 months of dishwashing, prep, acting as the bottom-rung piss boy for a busy kitchen crew, usually while treated as only slightly more interesting than a mouse turd, if you still like the restaurant business and think you could be happy among the ranks of the damned, then welcome. At this point, having established ahead of time that you are one fucked-up individual, that you'd never be happy in the normal world anyway, culinary school becomes a very good idea. But choose the best one possible. If nothing else, you'll come out of culinary school with a baseline knowledge and familiarity with techniques. The most obvious advantage of a culinary education is that from now on, chefs won't have to take time out of their busy day to explain to you what a fucking brunoise is. Presumably, you'll know what they mean if they shout across the room at you that you should braise those lamb necks. You'll be able to break down a chicken, open an oyster, fillet a fish. Knowing those things when you walk in the door is not absolutely necessary. But it sure fucking helps. When you do get out of culinary school, try to work for as long as you can possibly afford in the very best kitchens that will have you as far from home as you can travel. This is the most important and potentially invaluable period of your career, and where I fucked up mine. I got out of culinary school, and the world seemed my oyster. Right away, I got, by the standards of the day, what seemed to be a pretty good paying job. More to the point, I was having fun. I was working with my friends, getting high, getting laid, and in general convincing myself that I was quite brilliant and talented enough. I was neither. Rather than put in the time or effort, then, when I had the chance to go to work in really good kitchens, I casually and unthinkingly doomed myself to second and mostly third and fourth tier restaurant kitchens forever. Soon there was no going back, no possibility of making less money. I got older, and the beast that needed to be fed got bigger and more demanding, never less. Suddenly, it was 10 years later, and I had a resume that was, on close inspection, unimpressive at best. At worst, it told a story of fucked up priorities and underachievement. The list of things I never learned to do well is still shocking in retrospect. The simple fact is that I would be, and have always been, inadequate to the task of working in the kitchens of most of my friends, and it is something I will have to live with. It is also one of my greatest regrets. There's a gulf the size of an ocean between adequate and finesse. There is as well a big difference between good work habits, which I have, and the kind of discipline required of a cook at Robuchon. What limited me forever were the decisions I made immediately after leaving culinary school. That was my moment as a chef, as a potential adult, and I let it pass. For better or worse, the decisions I made then about what I was going to do, whom I was going to do it with, and where, set me on the course I stayed on for the next 20 years. If I hadn't enjoyed a freakish and unexpected success with Kitchen Confidential, I'd still be standing behind the stove of a good but never great restaurant at the age of 53. I would be years behind in my taxes, still uninsured, with a mouthful of looming dental problems, a mountain of debt, and an ever more rapidly declining value as a cook. If you're 22, physically fit, hungry to learn and be better, I urge you to travel as far and as widely as possible. Sleep on floors if you have to. Find out how other people live and eat and cook. Learn from them wherever you go. Use every possible resource you have to work in the very best kitchens that will have you, however little, if anything, they pay. And relentlessly harangue every possible connection, every great chef whose kitchen offers a glimmer of hope, of acceptance. Keep at it. A 3-star chef friend in Europe reports receiving month after month of faxes from one aspiring apprentice cook and responding with no each time. But finally, he broke down, impressed by the kid's unrelenting, never-wavering determination. Money borrowed at this point in your life so that you could afford to travel and gain work experience and really good kitchens will arguably be better invested than any student loan. A culinary degree, while enormously helpful, is only helpful to a point. A year working at Mugaritz or L'Arpège or Arzak can transform your life, become a direct route to other great kitchens. All the great chefs know each other. Do right by one, and they tend to hook you up with the others. Which is to say, if you're lucky enough to be able to do the above, do not fuck up. Like I said, all the great chefs know each other. Let me repeat, by the way, again, that I did none of the things above. It's a little sad sometimes when I look out at a bookstore audience and see young fans of Kitchen Confidential for whom the book was a validation of their worst natures. I understand it, of course, and I'm happy they like me. But I'm a little more comfortable when the readers are late-career hackers and journeymen like I was when I wrote the book. I like that they relate to the highs and lows, the frustrations and absurdities, that they too can look back with a mixture of nostalgia and very real regret on sexual liaisons on cutting boards and flour sacks, late-night Coke jags, the crazy camaraderie that seems to come only in the busiest hash house restaurants or failing ones. I wrote the book for them in the first place, and it's too late for them anyway. But the young culinary students, thousands and thousands of them, new generations of them every year, resplendent in their tattoos and piercings, I worry that some of them might have missed the point. At no point in Kitchen Confidential that I can find does it say that cocaine or heroin were good ideas. In fact, given the book's many episodes of pain, humiliation, and being constantly broke-ass, one would think it almost a cautionary tale. Yet at readings and signings, I'm frequently the inadvertent recipient of small packets of mysterious white powder, bindles of cocaine, fat, carefully rolled joints of local hydro pressed into my palm or slipped into my pocket. These inevitably end up in the garbage or handed over to a media escort. The white powder is because I'm a recovered fucking addict. And the weed because all I need is one joint, angel dust laced by some psycho to put me on TMZ running buck naked down some Milwaukee street with a helmet made from the stretched skin of a butchered terrier pulled down over my ears. Smoking weed at the end of the day is nearly always a good idea, but I'd advise ambitious young cooks against sneaking a few drags mid-shift at Danielle. If you think smoking dope makes you more responsive to the urgent calls for food from your expediter, then God bless you, you freak of nature, you. If you're anything like me, though, you're probably only good for a bowl of Crunchberries and a Simpsons rerun. On the other hand, if you're stuck heating up breakfast burritos at Chili's or dunking deep-fried macaroni at TGI McFuckwads, maybe you need that joint. Treating despair with drugs and alcohol is a time-honored tradition. I just advise you to assess honestly if it's really as bad and as intractable a situation as you think. Not to belabor the point, but if you look around you at the people you work with, many of them are or will eventually be alcoholics and drug abusers. All I'm saying is you might ask yourself now and again if there's anything else you wanted to do in your life. I haven't done heroin in over 20 years, and it's been a very long time as well since I found myself sweating and grinding my teeth to the sound of tweeting of birds outside my window. There was and is nothing heroic about getting off coke and dope. There's those who do and those who don't. I had other things I still wanted to do, and I saw that I wasn't going to be doing shit when I was spending all my time and all my money on coke or dope, except more coke and dope. I'm extremely skeptical of the language of addiction. I never saw heroin or cocaine as my illness. I saw them as some very bad choices that I walked knowingly into. I fucked myself and eventually had to work hard to get myself unfucked. And I'm not going to tell you here how to live your life. I'm just saying, I guess, that I got very lucky. And luck is not a business model.